This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org, and by Cargill, collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Oh, for the joy of good news, even if it's really not. 0.3% rise in retail sales last month. I'm sorry, people, but this economy is going to need a lot more help than that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the studios of KPBS in San Diego, California, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday, everybody. It's the 13th of February today. This morning's news on retail sales gave Wall Street what some analysts were calling an upside surprise. The numbers seemed to show an unexpected rise in sales during January. Investors decided that was cause enough for celebration because, who knows, maybe the economy didn't slip into a recession last month after all. Maybe the American consumer will muddle through. But Marketplace's Bob Moon reports there are plenty of people who don't see any upside surprise, just more downside reality.
Attention, Wall Street. Your reality check just bounced.
If people think that this was a good report, I think they've likely misread it.
Commerce Bank Chief Economist Joel Naroff says stock market traders seem to be grasping at any sign that things aren't really so bad.
A good surprise is taken as positive news, even if that news isn't very positive, which is the case today.
The general consensus had been that retail sales would drop by at least 0.3% in January. Instead, the Commerce Department reported a 0.3% increase. But read beyond the headline number, and purchases outside automobiles and gasoline were unchanged. In other words, to Wall Street, no news is good news. But Naroff says the reality is consumer spending is slowing down.
The only good thing we can say about it, if it's a good thing, is that the consumer is not really stopping spending a whole lot, but they are clearly spending an awful lot less than they had been.
At AG Edwards, chief market strategist Al Goldman has been scratching his head over the market's rally this week. He says corporate profit reports will be the next unwelcome surprise.
Carpet earnings are not going to be up 15% to 16% like analysts are predicting, and that enthusiasm will be taken out of the marketplace sooner or later, and I think sooner.
Goldman says some traders were obviously assuming prices are nearing their low point and doing what he calls some bottom fishing today, but he thinks they're too optimistic. Today's retail numbers do seem to support more interest rate cutting by the Fed. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The government's done its bit to get consumer spending again. President Bush signed the stimulus package today, called it a booster shot for the economy. You can look for that rebate check along about May sometime. The Federal Reserve, as Bob mentioned, has been trying to help as well, cutting interest rates and pumping cash into the system. But despite Mr. Bernanke's best efforts, many credit card users are finding their rates and fees heading up, not down. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports now from Washington that banks are putting a new price tag on lending.
When stocks were rising and homes were appreciating, lending was easy business. No more, says Greg McBride of Bankrate.com.
As we've seen the unwinding of the subprime mortgage market and now an economic slowdown that is sure to breed higher unemployment and higher delinquency on other forms of credit, lenders are reevaluating that stance.
As banks lose money on mortgages, they're making up for it by charging more for credit. That makes consumers more reluctant to borrow, and the economy suffers. It's what former bank regulator Eugene Ludwig calls a vicious cycle.
Which is a recessionary cycle, where because folks have had trouble paying, institutions become more conservative in lending and raise rates, and that more conservative bias makes credit less available and makes it actually more difficult for individuals to get the kind of credit they need to stay afloat.
Raising interest rates and fees can hurt credit card companies in the end, generating more delinquencies and defaults. But Ludwig says, don't blame the lenders.
From a social policy, a macro perspective, we want to support that borrower as much as possible. But from an individual company's perspective, it's pretty hard when you look at their income stream and you say, well, I can't lend them more, their income is less.
As if struggling customers weren't bad enough, Jim McTague, the Washington editor of Barron's, says lenders are also feeling pressure from investors.
A lot of the department stores that have their own credit cards, even ones that haven't yet experienced an exaggerated rate of default, are being pommeled by Wall Street because Wall Street's so afraid of the subprime situation spilling over in the credit markets that they're knocking down the prices of these stocks.
So far, the Federal Reserve Board's policy of making cheaper money available to credit card lenders isn't trickling down to everyone. Consumers with the slightest hint of credit risk are paying a higher price for debt. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
A brief detour to fashion now. It is the beauty of radio that we can wear what we want in the studio, and none of you are any the wiser. Slacks and a button-down today. It's fine and all, but it's not really useful, you know? Today, researchers announced what you could call a new power shirt. It is still experimental, but one day it might do more than just look good. Janet Babin reports from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
If James Bond were more eco-friendly, this is the shirt he would wear. It would let him turn all that running he does into electricity to power his fancy gadgets. The real-life Q who designed this power shirt is Professor Zhonglin Wang at the Georgia Institute of Technology. It wasn't international intrigue, but routine exercise that led to the discovery. Wang says one question would nag him while he worked out.
How can I make this energy when I do exercise to be useful to some purposes?
The shirt is made with nanoscale wires of zinc oxide, way thinner than a human hair. When they rub against each other, they create an electric charge.
So this is called energy harvesting from the environment.
The shirt could be worn by soldiers on the battlefield to power night goggles or by hikers far from an electric outlet. Wang says the aerospace, biomedical, and defense industries are interested in the experimental shirt, but the technology may be difficult to mass produce. University of Chapel Hill professor Joe DeSimone says nanomaterials are fragile.
One of the biggest linchpins in lots of nanotechnologies is the ability to go from these single one-off devices into something that's fabricatable in a robust manner.
The shirt also needs to be safe. Andrew Maynard is with the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies. He says we have to make sure the materials in the shirt stay put.
Can they get out of that product into the environment? Can people breathe them in? Can people eat them? Can they pass through the skin?
One thing you can't do with the shirt so far is wash it. Zinc oxide is sensitive to moisture. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, investors took that retail sales number all the way to the bank. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. When you go online, it's easy to think that it's just you and your computer. But the big telecommunications companies know exactly who's using what sites and for how long. They know because our web access passes through their digital pipelines, which means if they wanted to, companies like Comcast and Verizon could control what sites we can get to and how much we'd have to pay for the privilege of doing it. It's a lingering policy debate that goes by the name net neutrality. And Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports the battle was joined once again today on Capitol Hill.
A new bipartisan bill would give the FCC more authority to make sure service providers don't discriminate in delivering internet traffic to users. Timothy Carr with Free Press supports the legislation. He says telecom giants pose a threat to consumer freedom if they're allowed to slow down or block traffic to some sites and speed it up to others.
When you allow a very powerful company to sort of dictate who gets access and where they can go, I'd say that's a fundamental violation of very basic democratic principles.
For example, he says, cable and internet giant Comcast may be getting a little jealous of all that online video downloading.
They want to get into that business, and the way that they're doing that is through blocking this kind of consumer-driven use of video and trying to steer people towards their legacy products.
Like their own cable TV. Christopher Wolf denies that's going on. He's with the Hands Off the Internet Coalition that represents internet providers like AT&T and Quest. Wolf says companies should be able to price services as they wish.
The downside of enacting across the board government regulation of the internet is that it will have the effect of hindering the development of the internet at a time when we need greater broadband capacity.
One option that's probably not available is to keep things the way they are.
Christopher Yu teaches law and communications at the University of Pennsylvania. He says the demands on broadband are out of control and solutions like tiered pricing could help ease congestion. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The heart of the internet is in India for a meeting this week. It sounds geeky, I know, but the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers makes an essential part of the web possible. ICANN, as it's known, is the independent group responsible for domain names, like marketplace.org. Back in the early days of the web, there were what you might call speculators in domain names, people who bought internet addresses hoping to flip them later for big money. Well, a lot of those internet addresses ended up as empty lots, but now the developers are moving in. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli surveys the landscape.
Digital fixer-uppers have made Mike Zappelin a wealthy man. He got started in the early days of the web when he bought the domain beer.com for $80,000 from a college kid. Zappelin took down the frat party pictures and spiffed things up.
We took the site, we redeveloped it as sort of a lifestyle community site for beer enthusiasts, how to brew beer, rate your favorite beer, get a free app, beer.com email.
3 months later, a major international brewer summoned Zappelin to its headquarters and offered him a deal.
We wound up selling it to them for $7 million cash.
Zappelin's not the only guy who's looking for gold and domain names. Private equity firms have been injecting cash into domain name companies. One company in Massachusetts has filed papers to raise $175 million in an IPO. Generic domain names like board.com, B-O-R-E-D, are commanding millions of dollars.
The most valuable domains are the generic descriptive dictionary words that are open to a lot of potential uses specific to industries and classes of goods and services.
Jeremiah Johnson's company, Sato.com, brokers domain names. Sales at the company doubled last year to $70 million, largely based on a single premise.
Believe it or not, a lot of people use domains as their primary navigation device for the web. Instead of going to a search engine, they'll just type a domain into their browser, assuming that they're going to find content there that is relative to what they're looking for.
Speculating in domain names is like buying undeveloped beachfront property and waiting for someone to make you an offer. The difference is with virtual real estate, you can generate income until you sell. Adam Strong owns 10,000 generic domain names like racing.com.
I've got a space on the internet. People happen to drive by typing in the domain name, and then I show them advertising.
And in return for offering advertisers the traffic, Strong gets some cash. Not everybody's so sure domain names are a solid investment. Ken Wilbur is a marketing professor at the University of Southern California Marshall School of Business.
If internet users become a little more sophisticated and start using search engines in place of just typing the facts that they're looking for into their browser, you really could be looking at significant losses in value.
Digital domain renovator Mike Zappelin isn't worried. He believes domains are bound to become more valuable as online advertising continues to grow.
Every one percentage point that it goes up is $7 billion. That's a $50 billion more advertising money looking for a home on the internet.
Which is why he's staking his future on that old real estate saw. Location, location, location. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Pacific Gas and Electric spent $700,000 on lobbyists last year. Media giant Time Warner, a cool $624,000 to lobby the feds in 2007. The American Apparel and Footwear Association, $870,000 to fight shoe tariffs and some other trade issues. We know that because they had to tell us. The Senate posted disclosure forms earlier this week. Commentator and lobbyist Brian Palish hears all the usual gripes, but he says he and his colleagues actually help, not hinder, Washington.
Listen to the stump speeches of the presidential candidates, and you'll hear a lot about lobbyists. Barack Obama wants to tell the lobbyists that their days of setting the agenda in Washington are over. Hillary Clinton promises to permanently ban her cabinet officials from lobbying her administration once they've left office. And John McCain brags that his national energy policy won't be a full employment act for lobbyists. The lobbyists may be a convenient punching bag in an election year, but lobbying is a fundamental right guaranteed by our Constitution. The First Amendment states, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom to petition the government for a redress of grievances. And lobbyists help people accomplish that. Why is that important? Say you're passionate about finding a cure for Parkinson's disease. You can try to be a lone voice in the wilderness, but chances are there's a lobbying organization that can bolster your argument with research and facts, and the ability to get that information to the people who make the decisions. Critics like to slam lobbyists as stand-ins for special interests. That's the funny thing about special interests. They're easily dismissed as special until they're yours. Lobbyists represent all points of view on issues confronting the country. Environment, labor, the elderly, veterans, but also privacy advocates, pet owners, and even online poker players. That's the great thing about America. Everyone has a voice. And lobbyists are an effective way to get those voices heard. 5,000 bills are introduced during a congressional session. And lobbyists perform an important function. They explain the practical effects of that legislation on the groups they represent. A responsible elected official should consider the information and arguments from both sides of an issue, then make the right decision for his constituents. Unfortunately, too many politicians choose to take cheap shots. When they do, they diminish the public policy process.
Brian Palish is the president of the American League of Lobbyists in Washington, D.C. I guess that makes him a lobbyist for lobbyists. Tell us about your pet cause. Our website is marketplace.org. Coming up, oh, how we struggle to land the perfect Valentine's Day gift.
It's not that they're stupid or lazy. It's just that men are a little clueless when it comes to gifts, and this one has such a heavy baggage attached to it.
I don't know. I'm pretty sure I resent that remark. But anyway, let's do the numbers. Markets jigged up today on the belief that perhaps tech companies might be recession-proof. The Dow Industrial swelled 178 points. That's almost 1.5% to close at 12,552. The NASDAQ advanced 53 points, 2.3% to end at 2373. The S&P 500 added 18 points, 1.3% to finish at 1367. Investors snapped up shares of Applied Materials today. The giant maker of semiconductor equipment danced up more than 10%. Orders are surging for machines that make flat-screen TVs. Network Appliance, maker of storage data computers, powered up 7%. Apple picked up 3.75% today. Research in Motion shimmied up 5.75%. The price of the 10-year T-note fell. That means the yield rose. The number in this case is 3.73%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working to help reduce greenhouse gases with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. By Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. And by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services,
pandemic flu is a real threat, but there are steps you can take to prepare. More information at takethelead.pandemicflu.gov. Every day's marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. It's Valentine's Day. Retailers are hoping some sweetheart spending will improve their lagging sales figures. The typical man's expected to spend more than $150. Women tend to spend around $85. And on this day in 1966, the Rolling Stones, those legendary rockers that still get plenty of love from their fans, appeared for the first time on The Ed Sullivan Show. I'm Stephen Hoffman.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The U.S. Trade Representative Susan Schwab said today she thinks negotiators are on the verge of a breakthrough on something called the Doha Round. Wait, before you reach to Google to find out what that is, I'll just tell you, it's the latest set of global trade talks. They're supposed to end up with there being fewer barriers to free trade around the world. But the talks have been hung up for a year now, maybe more, on one key issue. Agricultural subsidies, how much governments pay their farmers to grow, or in some cases not to grow their crops. But with world food prices skyrocketing, a funny thing has happened on the way to Doha. Food tariffs are changing, which might change how everybody feels about those subsidies. Homi Karas is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. We've asked him to help explain. Mr. Karas, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Mr. Karas, food prices are rising around the world. Remind us how that's affecting food tariffs and what's going on there.
Well, what's happening is two things. A number of food importing countries have started to lower their import tariffs to try to offset the impact of high international prices on their domestic consumers. And then on the other side, a number of food exporting countries are trying to make sure that more of their food stays at home and keeps prices low. So they're putting on export taxes to stop their farm exporters from selling abroad and keep them selling domestically.
Is this sort of a turning on its head of food tariffs the way we've known them to be?
Well, certainly it changes the politics of food tariffs enormously, because food tariffs have been imposed certainly by developing countries because they've worried about the incomes of poor farmers. But of course, with international food prices going up so high, there's no longer such a great need for protection of these farmers. So that changes the political equation quite a lot.
Is it more power to the growers really now because these food prices are rising?
Absolutely. Growers, people in rural areas who actually have not been great beneficiaries of world trade to date, now for the first time in maybe a generation, are seeing their prospects also starting to improve.
Let me try to make this a little bit more concrete and give an example. The one that comes to mind is ethanol tariffs here in this country, corn-based product that we in this country have very, very high import tariffs on. Any chance that's going to change?
I don't think so in the United States. But, for example, the European Union just eliminated all tariffs on cereals in an effort to stop food prices from rising so rapidly in Europe. India, for example, halved its tariffs on palm oil prices. Cooking oil is very important to a lot of people in India. So in lots of countries around the world, you're seeing very significant changes in their policies.
What about in countries that are raising their tariffs? China has put very high tariffs on certain exported goods. Are food prices rising there?
Well, yes. And in an effort to try to stem increases in food prices in China, the Chinese government is trying to get their farmers to keep more of their goods at home and sell it into domestic markets. And of course, what that does is it makes international prices rise even more, because the normal impact of higher prices, which is to get more supply into the international market, is being offset by these domestic policies. And China isn't alone. Argentina has done exactly the same with beef exports. They've stopped beef exports, forcing Argentinian producers to sell beef in their domestic markets. And temporarily, that has kept beef prices in Argentina low. But in the long run, there is a danger that it could damage the beef industry.
In the long run, global food prices can't keep going up like this. They'll eventually steady out, if not drop. And then what happens to this change in tariffs that we're seeing?
Food prices have always been very volatile. And so countries have been reluctant to actually bind their tariffs because they can't really tell how far food prices are likely to move in one direction or the other. So they like to keep a great deal of flexibility in what they're allowed to do under WTO rules. And that's what's blocking an agreement.
Homi Karas is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Mr. Karas, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Investors in the internet jewelry store Blue Nile are seeing red today. Shares in the web's biggest diamond retailer tumbled almost 17% after the company said earnings are going to miss expectations. Jewelers online and at the mall are seeing slim sales since the last holiday season, probably why they're amping up Valentine's Day marketing by advertising simple ways to show you care. You know, simple, like diamonds. Caitlin Carroll's been checking out the sparkle from in front of the TV.
I think that possibly
this way. Let her know she's made your life wonderful.
Did you hear that? That's the gasp of a woman getting a Journey diamond pendant. It's S-shaped and sculpted to delight the woman you love. You've seen the ads if you've watched any sports whatsoever. But then why am I sitting at home on the couch, annoyed by how schmaltzy these commercials are? This fairy tale motif doesn't work on guys, does it?
When you look at all of those commercials, what you see is the guy really coming in, saving the day, being this wonderful man with this big, great gesture. And I think that appeals to them the same way the romance appeals to women as the recipient.
So marketing expert Jen Drexler says, I'm not the target for these ads. Well, you know, I don't want that S-shaped pendant anyway.
Well, you know, somebody once said to me, when he gives you jewelry, never criticize because then he'll stop giving you jewelry. Eventually, just drop enough hints and you'll get what you want.
Okay, I want an iPhone. Is that a good enough hint? Actually, I think that's the problem. Guys don't always listen to hints. They take their cues from ads between games. Like shopper Alex Vong. He's at the mall scoping out diamonds for his fiancé.
What do you think a gift of diamond earrings sort of says about how you feel?
I think she deserves it. She's earned it. Been with her for 10 years, so something that I'm sure all women would like.
All women, except for me. I must be in the minority, because last year stores sold $2.5 billion worth of jewelry just in the month of February, mostly to guys.
It's not that they're stupid or lazy. It's just that men are a little clueless when it comes to gifts, and this one has such a heavy baggage attached to it that if you don't get Valentine's Day right, you must not really care.
I know that my boyfriend cares about me, but I still want to know what he thinks is the best way to demonstrate love.
Then be in love. You know, wear matching costumes on Halloween and wear matching powdered wigs on President's Day. But don't get all bunched up about blowing a bunch of money on Valentine's Day. It's kind of for suckers.
Suckers. When confronted with the real possibility of no gift, that Journey diamond pendant is starting to look pretty good. Possibly giftless in Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note from the month of February, the year 2008. Think hands-free phones, televisions the size of your wall, this newfangled thing called plastic. That was the vision of the future back in 1957 when Disneyland opened its first House of the Future with funding from Monsanto. Technology marched on, the plastic pod fell out of date and closed. Now, though, Disney's trying to peer into the crystal ball once again. With $15 million from Microsoft, Hewlett-Packard, and a couple of others, the Mouse House is going to erect a new home in Tomorrowland. This time around, it'll have nifty automated closets to help you choose your outfits, countertops that can suggest recipes, but still and sadly, no Jetson-style robot made for you. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 178 points, nearly 1.5%.
The NASDAQ added 53 points, 2.3%. The S&P 500 bumped up 18 points, 1.3%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbornoni, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Thanks today to the staff at KPBS down here. Coming up next time on this program, when a professional sense of smell is a heavy burden.
For example, if I am in a plane and the person 3 seats away has been sweating too strong or ate garlic, I need to change seat.
Our series Working continues. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.